Good morning. We are holding now in Tanya, we are holding at the top of page, Vav. This is the end of Perek Aleph. We're holding by on the first line on the top, right, on the same page where Perek Beis begins. We're holding by the words "Vegam Midos Tovos Shebetava Kol Yisrael." That's where we're holding. Okay. So now, just a brief recap of where we were holding, where we left off. In our last class, the Tanya introduced to us the concept of the two souls. It's that it says in Eitz Chaim from the Arizal that every single person possesses two souls. And this goes beyond the idea, as we're soon going to explain, beyond the idea of Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara, evil inclination and good inclination. This takes it to a whole new level, that we all possess two souls. And he begins his explanation, you know, one is a holy soul, a godly soul, and the other one is an animal soul, an unholy soul. However, he begins to first introduce to us the unholy soul, the one that is more familiar to us because we're more conscious of that soul. The reason why he begins with that soul, as explained last week or 2 weeks ago, is because that's the soul that is emerges into, it settles in the body at an earlier stage. The godliest soul, the higher soul, the neshama, the nefesh elokis, mainly makes itself fully or registers in the body primarily at the age of 13 or 12 to a girl. A little bit comes in at the bris, when you're born, but then it slowly it introduces itself in stages. It's fully manifest at the age of 12 and 13. However, Bar and Bas Mitzvah, however, the animal soul is there immediately. Now, he said two things. Now, this animal soul, he said two things about the animal soul, which is important to review. The first thing he said about the animal consciousness in man is that that soul is responsible for our biological life. It's the biological soul. It's the soul that animates the body. It gives us the physical energy, the physical vitality that the body needs to function. The body, of course, needs a spirit. The body is without the spirit, without the spiritual dimension, it's dead. So this soul encloses itself, as he says, as we learned in the other class, in the blood, and through the blood, as the medium, it travels and spreads throughout the entire body. Then we have, that's one soul. That's one thing he says about the soul, is that it's the soul that animates the physical body. Second thing he says about the soul, about this animal soul, is that it is responsible from its stem, all the unholy personality traits and characteristics are all derived from this impure soul, from the Nefesh HaBahamas. Depending on the composition of the elements, we have four elements that are the source of all material, of all substance. In the physical world, as the ancient philosophers have always spoken about, and there is explanations of how this relates even to modern science today, what it means that there are these four elements, but there definitely is a factor in, even in today's perception of things, that there are four, there's four elements. And the four elements that make up everything, fire, wind, water, and earth. Now, these four elements make up the everything physical, from stones, or even, you know, even things that really belong to one element, let's say the earth, it too has within it all four elements. But everything we see, whether it's a tree, a plant, an animal, fish, birds, human beings, everything that there is consists of these four elements. The physical things, but also spiritual things, also have the spiritual elements of fire, wind, water, and dust. Now, being that this soul is an unholy soul, so the four elements within the soul are unholy. That's why they produce various characteristics that are not good, that are negative characteristics in the human being. And we learned last week, whether it's the pride and the arrogance of pride and anger that come from the fire within the soul, the unholy fire and the animal soul, or it's the laziness and depression that come from the earth element, or the appetite for pleasure, the lusting for the constant searching for pleasure, the desire for pleasure that comes from the water element, because water produces all kinds of pleasurable things, or the eerie part of the soul, which is the elements that are lacking anything substantial in the human being, the character, negative character traits such as scoffing and frivolousness and wasteful idle chatter and things like that, which are prompted by the ear in the soul. And again, every person has to deal with these elements depending on the combination of the elements of the consistency and the anatomy of this, of his or her animal soul. Meaning there are more people that have a greater dose of fire. The fire is dominant in their being, and that's why the primary traits are fiery, which result in they have a great tendency, a natural inclination towards anger and pride rises upward and so forth, a fiery element. And there are some people that are of more of a tendency, their negative side results in melancholiness, depression, sadness, or laziness, heaviness, because the earth is strong, the earth element in their animal soul. We can possess all these things. The question is, which one is stronger than the other? Every human being is different in the consistency of these elements. The reason why it's negative is because this is coming from an unholy soul, and therefore all the elements in it are unholy, therefore it's producing these unholy feelings. Now he's going to go on to say that this soul isn't purely unholy, it isn't purely bad, it has some bit of good to it too. Especially by Jewish people, even this animal soul has natural inclinations towards goodness. Nothing to do with work, nothing to do with development, personal development. It's within the nature of every Jew, because this animal soul in a man stemming from this unholy place is coming from a realm of unholiness that has a little good to it. And that is why it results in some good traits in the human being that are there without toil, without effort. The real good traits are connected to our godly soul, the second soul. But that takes effort, that takes work in order to reveal the soul and to develop it. The natural animal soul, however, also possesses a little bit of good in it. Okay, that's what we're going to learn about soon. But before we do that, I just want to emphasize a few very important points about what we learned 2 weeks ago. We touched upon it, but didn't really fully explain it, which is very important. When he speaks about the soul, he emphasized that this soul, its origins, its place where it comes from, is from the place called, it's the unholy realm. And he calls it, it comes from Klipa, from the side of Klipa, which means it's the Kabbalistic term for the realm of evil, or the realm of unholiness. It's called Klipa, shell, literally translated as a shell, and Sitra Achra, which means the other side. Now, by just thinking a little bit of that term, when we term the unholy by calling it Klipa and Sitra Achra, that tells us, gives us a lot of insight into the whole Hasidic approach to things, those deeper understanding. See, evil has a name in Kabbalah as Klipa. What does Klipa mean? It's a shell. When we say it's a shell, it means it's covering on something. That is due to the idea that at the core of everything is goodness, because God is at the core of everything. And nothing can exist without Hashem being invested in it. And Hashem is good. So there has to be a spark of godliness, a spark of Hashem in everything. So when we say something is evil, it means that that entity is covering on the good that's in it. So there is a mixture. There is nothing in this world that doesn't have good. Ein toiv b'loi ra, ein ra b'loi. There's everything till we get to Mashiach. When Mashiach comes, there will be things that are in this world that are purely good. Or even now, as a result of our Torah and mitzvahs, we make things purely good. But when the world, after the sin of the Eitz Hadas, there was a mixture in this world where there's good and bad mixed together. now, which meant that there isn't any pure good and there isn't any pure bad. And even the, but now we're going to concentrate on the on the part of the bad element. There isn't anything that's purely bad. There has to be some good. It's only that the good is concealed. Meaning to say something like this. What is good in this world? Good is things that reveal the godly, its godly power. It's the spark of godliness that's within it. Something that acknowledges, senses that God is aware of the godly life force. It's aware that God is responsible for its existence, and therefore, it's surrendered and in submission to Hashem, which means it recognizes itself as a servant of God. That is holy. That is good. Holiness, as the term later in Tanya, are all things that are in submission to Hashem, that are here, that recognize God, and are ready to acknowledge that God is the core of their existence, and therefore their identity and their being, what they're all about, is serving their Creator. Then they are holy, because God, holiness is Hashem. Hashem is revealed, He's expressed in their life. Because when they're operating, and they're moving, and they're doing, whatever they're doing in service of the Creator. For example, an angel. An angel is holy. Why is an angel holy? Because angels, most angels, are very, very sharply aware, very strongly aware that God is bringing them into existence every second, and therefore every moment of the existence they live in a perpetual state of hineni. Hineni, I'm here to serve you, Hashem. I'm here to do what you want. The angel doesn't kick back and say what I want. It's constantly in a state of worshiping its Creator. So you know when the angel is flying through the sky, you know he's on a mission. You know he's going somewhere. And if he's not on a mission, he's praising his Creator. He's drawn close to his Creator. So his life is about God. And because his life is about God, there's expressed holiness over there. Then those things that don't express and that don't recognize Hashem as being the source of their existence, meaning they're blocking on it, instead of feeling God, if you don't feel God, who replaces God? You feel yourself. And you become, in other words, I exist. And recognize that there is a cause for my existence, an underlying root to what makes me be. So if I don't feel God as the root of my existence, then I just am. You feel the second stage of existence, which is yourself, not the source of your beingness. Then, what are you doing? Then you're living your life serving yourself. Then you're at the root of your existence. It's all about me, I am. And that's why the core of all unholiness, according to Chassidus, is the ego, the sense of I am. I am not as a servant to something bigger than me, but I am as an end to myself. And therefore my life is here to serve me. It's all about me, what I need, what I want. That's the sense of ani, of I am. That's the klipa. That's the unholiness. And this is a very, very, very powerful idea, is that even before we get into the expressions of this I, the ego, how it's manifesting itself, where it's taking on a negative, it's becoming evil, it's becoming really vulgar, and it's expressing itself in a wrongful thing, in something that's morally wrong or ethically wrong. Even before that, it's already unholy in the mere fact that it's not recognizing God. Which means like this. If you look in Tanya, he says about the animal soul, the first thing he says about it is that it's here to enliven the body. Then he adds something else. And from it come all the all negative personality traits. Personality traits like anger, pride. See, anger, pride is something that we all know are bad. Being extremely lustful and very, very into indulgence, we understand that's not a mensch, that's not good. A person shouldn't be so into themselves and into their pleasures and the like. Depression, all these things are, we know, are negative, they're bad. However, the very, Chassidus is saying, what the Tanya is saying is, that before all of that, before you even get to that, the general feeling of I am, that is really the unholiness already. The manner in which that unholiness is expressing itself is already stage two. I am, therefore, I am so important that if anybody dare steps on my toes, then they're going to get it. So that's the anger that is a result of the I am. But before you even get to the anger, before the anger erupts, or there is an explosion of the anger, there is already what enables the anger. What enables the anger? I am so important that if anybody steps in my way, then they're, you know, they're, that's no good. That really disturbs me. Or the pride, or even the fact that I am, because I am, and I am so important, therefore I should have everything that gives me sensation. And I pursue things that give me sensation very, very strongly. And I can't control myself. I can't say no to that because, why not? Because, what do you mean? I want it. It feels good for me, and therefore I should have it. So the taiva, the lusting, and the overindulgence and pleasures, that too is derived from the notion of I am. So all these negative traits that he speaks about, whether it's the negative trait of coming from the water, or it's coming from the earth, or coming from the fire, or coming from the wind in the person, these are all manifestations. And the next stage, stage number one, is the ego itself. And that's why he says, the very fact that this life, the animal consciousness, is here to enliven the body, which means its entire existence is just to live. It's my life, I'm here to live. Not doing anything bad, just self-preservation, self-enhancement. I'm going out and I'm eating. Doesn't have to be, see, the evil doesn't begin in the indulgence, even if there's no indulgence. The mere fact that a person is engaging in taking care of their body for no higher reason, not for any deeper cause, to serve something greater, but rather just to live. I want to live, that's why I'm eating. I want to live, that's why I'm shopping. I need to take care of myself. I want to live. I go out and I make a living. So all these things which are generally kosher are already belonging to the realm of the unholy, according to the Tanya, and according to the mystical element of the Torah. It belongs to the unholy just because of that. It's not holy. What does unholy mean? It's not holy. Why should it be holy? Why should someone be that shopping out there for shoes? What makes that holy? Well, you could make it holy if you add just a little thought. I need shoes so that I can go out and serve my Creator. I can go to shul. I need shoes. I can't go barefoot. So I need a pair of shoes for that. Oh, then you're introducing holiness. But if you don't introduce the holiness, it just in its mere state that I need shoes just that I should have shoes, there's nothing holy about that. And that is already a lie. That's a distortion. Because that's already accepting the realm of klipa, that there is an existence, there is a moment of beingness that is not connected to God. This very moment, God is creating you. He's creating your feet. He's creating, right, for you to serve Him. Every moment we ought to serve Him. So a moment that we're not acknowledging that is already unholy. So this is different than the perspective of halacha. In halacha, we know of three categories. We know of the mitzvah element, that which we all ought to do, positive things that we all ought to, which is considered a holy act. Then there are things that are forbidden, things that are negative. And then there is a middle gray area, which is permissible. It's called divrei rishus. You can do it. God says, go ahead. Nothing wrong with it. It's just permissible. As long as it's kosher, as long as it's not violating a commandment in Shulchan Aruch, it's okay. That's the way we perceive things from the halachic perspective. However, when we delve a little deeper and look at things from the more mystical perspective, we find out there is no middle gray area. If something is a mitzvah, it's holy. If it's not a mitzvah, anything that is not for God's sake, it's already in the unholy. If so, according to the mystical tradition or the mystical meaning, what we're learning over here, what is the difference between forbidden and permissible? The difference is like this. The permissible realm could be made holy. We could use it for God's, for the service, for worshiping our Creator, and thereby be made holy. The forbidden cannot be made holy. So brushing your teeth, or blow drying your hair, or clipping your nails, or eating, or taking a stroll in the park, these are all permissible things. They could be done with a God, they could be illuminated with a godly intention, and then they enter into the realms of holiness. If they're done just like this, no bad intentions, just but I'm taking a walk so that I can be healthy, there's nothing holy about it. And if it's not holy, it is negative. Because it's a lie. The person is living at that moment in a state that is not connected to the truth. And the truth is that, again, God created the park and He created you. And this act is not really taking Him into consideration unless you do, and that is I'm taking a walk so that I can get energy now so I can study Torah better, have a clear mind, and be a healthier Jew to serve my Creator. Then it is made holy. Now, forbidden things. If a person, for instance, is going to eat shellfish, something that's not kosher, or engage in any other kind of forbidden activity, that you can't make holy. You can have all the holy intentions in the world. You can say, I'm eating this so that I can have strength to serve my Creator, and it will not make it holy, because it's the forbidden. And anything that belongs to the forbidden cannot be changed. It is stuck in its unholiness. The permissible is unholy, and it needs a positive intention to make it holy. And that's the idea that we're learning over here, that our animal consciousness isn't bad per se, but it still belongs to the realm of the unholy in this, that it's not sensing and it's not aware of God. It's aware of itself. The I dominates. The root of it being is an I. Now this is a very interesting thing, because this lays an understanding of the very big difference that there is between the approach of perfecting and working on our negative emotions, or rather, eradicating the unholy, the negative personality traits and negativity within the man, from the perspective of from the Hasidic perspective, or from other perspectives, other approaches. For instance, the difference between Musar and Hasidus. In dealing with that which is negative in man. See, Musar approaches each one of these characteristics as its own thing. For example, anger, okay? Anger is no good. Pride or arrogance, that's no good. Laziness, no good. Wasting time, no good. So there is Musar Svarim, I'm talking about ancient Musar Svarim, which each one has its own chapter. There's a Shar Hakas, there's a portal of anger. And when you start, and what are you doing? You're addressing, when you're studying it, it's addressing the negativity of this particular thing. Anger is bad, because you're losing yourself then. You're not in control. It's like serving idols. And it goes through, brings all the Mamara Chazal, all the statements of the sages, of how ugly and how bad anger is. So, and a person learning it gets the information, gets inspired to fight his anger. Okay? But then you're done with your anger, you have the next chapter. Now you have to deal with your pride. And you see all the negative elements of pride and why it's bad and what's wrong with it. And when you finish with that, you have to go on to the next thing. So each thing is what we call its own parsha. Each thing is its own chapter. Everything is they're unrelated to each other, because they're all independent negative traits. From the Hasidic perspective, they're all really connected to one problem. See, the anger, these are all manifestations of the ego. The root core problem over here is that the person takes himself too seriously. You're feeling yourself instead of feeling God. So if you feel God as the core of your life, then you wouldn't feel all these things. So for instance, like if you have a balloon, and the balloon is filled with air, and it's protruding in somewhere, and you don't like it. So you push, you take the air, and you push the air out by stopping the air from flowing into that thing. But what's going to happen is, as you get the air to stop flowing, the air is there. So automatically, it has to find an outlet somewhere else. So it's going to stick itself out. So it's going to cause a protrusion in another place. If you're going to go and you're going to push it over there, you're going to not allow the air to express itself or come out in that place, it's automatically going to have to find somewhere else. Because at the core, you have all that air in that balloon. So wherever it's going to go out, it's going to go out here or it's going to go out over there. The better way of getting rid of this is to let some of the air out. If you let the ear out, automatically you're not going to have these protrusions, or it's coming out over here, it's going to come over there. And that's the difference. In Chassidus deals with the core of the problem. The core of all negative traits is an overblown I. What Chassidus tries to do is it tries to replace the sense of I am, the sense of the person, with a sense of God. In other words, by introducing God as the reality of things, by studying about Hashem. And the more you study about Hashem, and the more you study about the idea that God gives life to the world every second, and without the perpetual involvement of God, the world can't exist, including yourself. So then You become more conscious of God, and automatically the ego shrinks. Part of that is introducing your soul. The neshama has this holy consciousness. And what Chassidus tries to do is to draw out your neshama, to bring out your soul, so you live in a deeper consciousness, and with a minimized I, and with Hashem pervading your existence. And then automatically, all these individual negative traits get weakened. They don't change overnight, but they get weakened and weaker. And the more a person works on this, the stronger this gets. Okay. So this is the idea that we learned over here, that the root of all unholiness is the concealment of God. Again, it's coming from the klipa. The klipa means what is a shell that is blocking and concealing the creation or the entity from feeling God. If you don't feel God, so who then should you feel? You feel yourself. So then it's I am. I am is unholy. That feeling of I is unholy. And then depending on the chemistry of the soul, of the fire, water, wind, and earth, that's the type of negative I that is going to come out. It's going to emerge in this particular, with these particular character traits. So the two people can be suffering from the same ego, from the same I am, but they're going to be two completely different types of people. Meaning one is going to be a very angry person, and the other one is going to be very lazy, or very just, you know, into his wasting time and that kind of thing. The airy, because of the chemistry of the soul that's different. But the root of it is still the same, and that is the I am. Okay. Now, however, going back to the inside, well, to continuing from learning inside, on the top of page Vav, as he says, the Gam Midos Tovos, however, this soul, this animal soul, the Jewish animal soul, isn't only bad, it has good too. As he says, the Gam Midos Tovos, and also good character traits, Shebeteva Kol Yisrael, that is in the nature of all Jews, Bitoil Doisam, from their birth. See, there are certain characteristics that is natural to us from our birth. Just like Rachmanis, compassion. And kind-heartedness or generosity. So compassion and generosity. The Talmud says is that the sign of the Jewish people is that they are kind and that they are compassionate. It says really three things. They are bashful people, Baishanim, Rachmanim, and Goyim Lechasadim. They're bashful, and they're rachmanim, have compassion, and they're goyim lechasadim, and they're kind. So he says, the fact that this is a simen, this is a sign on the Jewish person, indicates that this has nothing to do with our higher godly soul. Because it's possible for a person to live their entire life and not, and a Jew being alive, and they haven't developed their godly consciousness. So if we're saying that this is natural to every Jew, we have to say that this is something that doesn't come from our godly soul. See, godly soul, to reveal our godly soul takes work and effort. The fact that this can be natural to the person must mean that this is connected to our natural existence. And our natural existence is our animal soul. Okay? So, Boaz Memena, come from this soul. Come from this unholy, generally unholy soul. Why? If it's a negative soul, if it's a soul of evil, how does it produce good? Kibi Yisrael, because by the Jewish people, Nefesh Zuda Klipa, this soul of Klipa that comes from the unholy, Him Klipas Noiga. It comes from the shell Klipa. It comes from a Klipa called the glowing shell. Sheyesh Boy Gam Kein Toiv, that also has good in it. Vihim Soid Eitzadas Toivera. And this is from the esoteric element of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. We said earlier that there are forces of unholiness. And what they're all about, these forces of unholiness, is they are all about concealing God. They're called klipa. Now in the writings of the Arizal, he differentiates between two types of klipa. There is really, he says, four klipos, four forces of evil that are within this world. However, when we say four, what it really means is that there are three that are on one level, two categories. There is a klipa called the glowing shell, and then there are the other klipas, which are the opaque shell. The other three, which are opaque. What does it mean, the glowing shell, which is called klipas noga? It means that it's a shell that glows because it allows a little bit of light to filter through. Generally, these are forces of concealment. They're blocking God. They're blocking Hashem. However, the question is, how deep Or how strong are they screening? How strong are they filtering? How deep is the concealment? These are three impure clippers which by there don't allow any godly light into them, which means that anybody who is deriving energy from these forces, or they themselves, or those recipients of life that are receiving their vitality from them, live in total darkness. Don't have any natural, okay, they can acquire the knowledge of God from outside means, but naturally, instinctively, they don't have a feeling of God. It's a total blackout. That's the impure klipa, complete impure. Klipas noga, this higher klipa, has a little trace. It's that's why we might call it the translucent klipa. It's not transparent to allow God completely through. It blocks, mostly it blocks. However, it leaves a little sensitivity, a little bit of light comes through as a result of that. As a result of it feeling God a little bit. So again, the ego is not so tough, not so thick. Because if you, again, one is connected to the other. If you feel your source, the less you feel yourself. And less you feel your source, then it's yourself. So the three impure klippas where God is completely blocked have a very, very intense feeling of self, of I am. So it's a real capital I. It's a real expanded ego. The klipas noiga is a little bit of a softer ego. As a result of it being a little bit softer, it has a sensitivity to be able to feel something that's outside of itself. See, when there is no sensitivity, when you don't feel God at all, like in the Shalosh Klipas HaTemeus, the three impure Klipas, and you feel yourself completely, you don't have the capability to feel anybody else but yourself. Doesn't mean you don't interact with people. Doesn't mean you don't have a social life. You do. But the core of everything that the person does is self-serving. In other words, I feel myself very much, and therefore I'm motivated by self. I'm reaching out to others. I will do for others, because by doing for others, that will enhance me. That will, hopefully, if I'm kind to you, you'll be kind to me tomorrow. So there is a self-interest, because in everything that is done, there must be a self-serving aspect. The more subtler klipa feels itself, but has, as we said earlier, a little sensation of their source. Thereby, again, the ego is not so thick and tough. As a result of that, it can feel other people. It can feel other people's pain. It can feel other people's need. And as a result of that, be giving to others. That's why he says the Jewish animal soul comes from this dark, from the klipa that's not completely dark. As a result of that, it has naturally a sense of other people. So that's why it's compassionate, and that's why, which means feeling the pain and the misery and the suffering of others, and it's also kind. It will be giving towards others. It won't take everything for itself. Now, Masha Ein Kein, what does that say? Now, how about the souls of other people? Does this mean that everybody's bad? No, let's see. Masha Ein Kein Nefashos Umos Ovdei Gelulim, which is in case of the souls of the nations of idol worship, of idol worshippers. Which generally, I mean, he says the idol worshippers, referring seemingly to the ancient pagans, but really it refers to generally the Gentile world. As he says, Hein Mishar Klipas Temeis. They are from the other impure Klipas. She'ein Bem Toiv Klal, that doesn't have a natural goodness at all. Now let me just for one moment emphasize something. That the Rambam writes that there are, first of all, the Chassidei Umay Sa'olam, the pious ones of the nations, and so the pious ones of the nations, it says in Kabbalah, they too possess a more refined animal soul. So there are people. In other words, to everything there is an exception. There are, we see, and we've seen in the history, and there are lots of people that are very, very special people, and people that have even given their lives. Especially, let's say, in the war, there are so many people that we know that have given their lives to save Jews. Not their own. So this is something that was done with that of my own family was saved by a Polish family. And they risked their lives. So these are called Chassidei Umay Sa'olam, the pious of the nations of the world. And their animal soul also comes from a world with the light, where it's not that dark. And as a result of that, they could feel others and even give themselves over to help completely, and even, again, even at the cost of their own life, as we've seen other times. We're speaking, however, generally, the non-Jewish animal soul is of a lower, coming from a lower dimension, where there is a less sensitivity towards, again, where there is a greater ego and less sensitivity towards someone else. Doesn't mean that they can't do good, even those who begin with an unholy soul, but they have to develop that goodness. It has to come through education. It has to come through a good upbringing. It has to come through their toil and work. This that we say that Jews are naturally kind, that's a uniqueness about the Jewish people, that our natural disposition or the natural inclination of our animal soul is to care for others. The non-Jew doesn't have that naturally. However, he could develop it, and many times, you know, we see so many people, so much charity that goes on for definitely in America, so much good. It's a developed goodness. Okay, so she'em b'mtev k'moshe koseh be'etz chayim, like it says in Etz Chayim, shar m'mtes peri gimel, as it says in Etz Chayim, portal 49, chapter 3, v'chol tivu da'avdin u'mois ov de gilulim, that all good that the nations of the world do, l'garmayu avdin, are done for a selfish motive, has some self-serving interest. That's what it said. Why? Because again, in Pri Etz Chaim over there, he explains where the root of the soul is. If the root of their animal soul, which is their natural consciousness, comes from the three impure klippas, the three impure klippas that have no good in them by its very nature, which means have no submission to God. As a result of it not having submission to God, it is full of it's full of itself. And when you're full of yourself, you can't feel someone else. When you will do good for someone else, you're thinking really of yourself. That's what he says over there. There is something to gain. Now, there are many levels in that. It doesn't mean always that it's real, that it's a real done in a very coarse manner. There are many ways where a person can be doing something for someone else, but really they're intending themselves. There can be a very, it can be in a very vulgar way, where, not vulgar, but in a very lowly way, where I'm doing something for the Yoman only because I know I'm giving you this today, so you'll help me tomorrow. So I'm just thinking about myself. There's nothing about you. I couldn't care less about your need and your state, but I know that that's the only way we can live amongst a society. If I will do to you, you'll be good to me tomorrow. So I will need you. It's an exchange kind of a thing. Then there can be a little bit more of a refined state where a person is doing it because they want to feel good about themselves. They want to feel like a good person. So again, that's not really because you care about the other, but it makes you feel perfect, makes you feel good. Or you're doing it to get a reward, to go to heaven. That too is a selfish interest. It's not, you're not caring for the other's pain. It's yourself. You want to go to heaven. You want to achieve something. Or it can be even on a more refined state. You can't bear to see other people in pain. But again, why are you doing it? To alleviate your own pain. See, it hurts you when someone else is suffering. So it's not, but it's, again, it's not when you're doing the act is to alleviate your own pain. When we're talking about doing something for others in a pure, in a Jewish way, it means you feel the other, and you're doing for the other because they need it, and there's no. It's not done with any selfish or self-interest. It's they need help, and this is what's amazing is that this is a natural inclination. Meaning, this is not something that we need to work on as Jews. We have it naturally from our animal soul, as opposed to even a higher type of a kindness that we have coming from our godly soul. When we develop our neshama, then it's even on a much more refined level. But even without the godly soul, even from the animal soul itself, the Jewish animal soul is coming from a place where there is good and bad. Primarily bad, but a little bit of good. It's interesting, the Gemara says three things that Jews possess. Beishanim, they're bashful people, and they're kind, and they're compassionate. He only mentions two of them. He doesn't mention beishanim, bashfulness. He only mentions kind and compassion. And the reason is because, as the Marsha says, that really, out of our nature, Jewish people are really azim shebu'umais. Azim meaning the firmest and toughest of all the nations. So really, this, that bashfulness is not our inborn nature. It was because we were stood by Har Sinai, and because of the intense revelation of God, that weakened our hardness, our toughness. And as from then on, we acquired collectively as a people the nature of bashfulness. But in essence, it's not there. That's why he doesn't mention it. Because he's talking about things that come to our soul, feelings that we have because of who we are and our nature. The nature of the Jewish soul is that it's very tough. It's needed for us in order for us to be able to make it, to have made it through the exile and so forth. But the bashfulness is a secondary thing that we acquired. But kindness and compassion is intrinsic to the Jewish, to the animal soul, even to the animal soul of man. Kedisa b'gemara, and he also continues this idea, this that he just mentioned earlier, that the all the good that the nations of the world do are doing it for their own sake. So he says it's also, this is not only stated in Kabbalistic works, but this is also stated in the Gemara. The Pasuk on the Pasuk says, V'chesed l'umim chatos, that the kindness of the nations is sin, is sinful. The Pasuk in Mishle, in Proverbs, that the kindness of the nations is a sin. What does it mean? What kind of sin? If they're doing kindness, what kind of sin? So the Gemara says in Masechtas Baba Basra, in Gedaf Yud, Shekol tzedakah v'chesed, that all charity and all kindness, that the nations of the world of idol worshippers do, isn't done for pure motives, it's done in order to promote themselves. That's the reason why it is done. So we see a Talmudic source for this too, that the natural state of the general public, not the unique souls, as mentioned earlier, there are unique souls that have a different kind of souls, even amongst the Gentiles. I'm not only talking about those who convert, even those who don't, meaning those who remain pious Gentiles all their life, have a higher soul. But the natural state of general Gentiles is a very selfish kind of a soul, and when it does good, it does it for personal motives. Unless they work on themselves. Again, this doesn't exclude that a person can't work on themselves to become a better person and a kind and generous person, where they're doing it to really care about others. But again, as we said earlier, that's something that they need to acquire. That's not something that's there to them naturally. So what we learned up till now is the condition of our animal soul, the Jewish animal soul, the lower soul of man, which generally is a klipa digas soul. Now, and the differentiation between the Jewish animal soul and the non-Jewish animal soul. Now, this concept that he mentioned over here, that there is two souls in us that are a godly soul, which we didn't learn yet about, and an animal soul, will also give a lot of insight into something which is an amazing idea in terms of, see, we mentioned earlier that it's not the way, see, up till we learn the Tanya, we generally think that the battle in life is between two inclinations. We have a good inclination and a negative inclination. But it's one soul. It's one soul that has a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara. This that the Tanya comes along and he says that we have two souls is adds a tremendous dimension and understanding in our lives, which really is a very liberating thought. Because if a person would only possess one soul and we have two inclinations, that means the battle in our life is in terms of our conduct. How will we conduct ourselves? Will I conduct myself so, or will I conduct myself so? Will I do a mitzvah, or will I do an avera? So it's more on the outer element of the person where the fight is taking place. The person himself is the same. It's who you are, whatever you are. If we're saying now that there are two souls, it means that the struggle in life is not just between two inclinations, but the struggle in life goes much deeper than conduct. The struggle in life gets to the very identity. The two elements of man is not inclination, it's two complete different souls. There's two personalities. There's one personality in man, which is a godly soul, which is, again, is a humble soul that recognizes God, doesn't have any ego, it's utterly selfless, and it's here to serve Hashem. It's a higher consciousness. And of course, this soul has a bunch of properties to it. Has emotions and has intellect, as we're going to learn later, and good and all kinds of positive characteristics. But even beyond those positive characteristics on a more elementary level, it's consciousness. Its very beginning, its sense of self is, it's here to serve God. That's its basic feeling. And there's another soul, a soul of ego, a soul that evolves around I am at the core of this being. And therefore, the life, the struggle in life is the implementation. These two souls are struggling for the very identity of the human being. If a person is living or sensing his godly soul, then his identity is, I am here to serve my Creator. If a person is not in touch with his godly consciousness, with his deeper consciousness, but he's in touch with his more external consciousness, which is his animal consciousness, then his being, his existence is, I'm here to serve me. Doesn't mean that they can't do, that they can't be doing good. He could do good, but the very root of it is, I am. It's my life is about myself. So, the difference would be in that, you know, you can, when we wake up in the morning, for instance, in the morning, and we generally wake up in animal consciousness. Because again, soul consciousness needs to be worked on in order for it to emerge into our minds and hearts. So we wake up in animal consciousness. And the animal consciousness we wake up is, you know, I'm here to have a good time. I'm here to live. That's the consciousness that begins. Then, as we go on in our day, again, if we feel, for instance, the negative impulses, where the person is already being drawn, I want to go do an aver, I want to do something wrong, I want to do something bad. And we fight it. You can fight it. You can say, you know, I'm not going to do that. It's a sin. I'm not going to do that. But in essence, the person is continuing to live his day still in his animal consciousness. It's only that he or she is restraining that emotion or that feeling and saying, you know what, I'm going to go daven, I'm going to go learn and so forth. I'm going to do something good. But the general approach is still an approach of animal consciousness. The idea of what we're learning over here in Tanya is that we have a higher neshama and a higher consciousness, and the point of what we're supposed to do right away in the morning is to access the deeper consciousness, and we do that through prayer. In other words, once we go to shul or whenever we're davening at home, that we start davening and we start speaking about God and about how God gives life to the world and is giving me life, and we begin to open up our neshama, our soul. And then hopefully by the end of the davening, our entire consciousness has moved to an elevated state. We're experiencing ourselves from the perspective of our soul. Here to serve my Creator. It's a whole different feeling. And then everything, automatically, the rest of the day is going to be running based on the deeper consciousness which we've experienced in the morning. The downside, or one of the things, of not being aware of this is that a person can get so frustrated in trying to figure out, like, what's going on with me? You know, if we don't know that we have two separate souls, and our take on life is, you know, that before we learn the Tanya, and that, you know, we have two inclinations, then it gets very, very, very painful when we wonder, why is it that we are so, we can be so contradictory at times. You know, yesterday is Shabbos, and we had, hopefully, Shabbos is an elevated time. We were in a state of spirituality. We were gravitating towards spirituality. We were pulling towards spiritual things. And then, you know, a day or two later, we find ourselves feeling so earthy and so materialistic. So we find that Rivka, for instance, this week in the parsha, was confused. She was feeling these, when she went through the house of Avodah Zarah, she was feeling the banging of the Esau who wanted to go out to the idols. And when she walked through the house of the shul, she felt the banging of Yaakov was banging. But she didn't know that it was two children. So she was at a loss. She said, what's going on? She thought this child was confused. Because where is he going? What is he all about? Is he about Kedusha or is he about the unholy? What gets this child ticking? Here he seems to be all excited about the negative. He seems to be excited about the good. So this really, really bothered her. She said, what kind of person is this? So she went to investigate. What did he tell him? He told him, it's two separate shnei goyim bebitnech. You have two things in your womb. Two separate souls, two children that are going to be born. This relaxed her. This made it bearable. Even though she knew she was going to have an Esav, but at least she knew that there is two things. This is one son, and this is another son. This son is a holy, representing the side of goodness. This one is representing the sign of the unholy. This Rivka dilemma is what so many people experience in their lives. They can't figure out what exactly is going on with them. How come when it comes Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Aseres Yemei Tshuva, they felt so godly, so spiritual, and so deeply desiring to do everything good and holy? And then, you know, sometimes a few weeks later, and all that is gone. So you begin to doubt, and you begin to think maybe it wasn't sincere, maybe all my spiritual moments aren't real, maybe it's just a figment of my imagination, maybe it's just fantasy, because after all, I have all these earthy cravings, how does this fit with these spiritual feelings? So the Tanya is saying, no, as we're going to see later, and Tanya, you have two souls. You're made up from two distinct beings. One is a heavenly being, one is an earthy being. One is a piece of God from above, and the other one is a part of the Klipa realm. And they reside together. Your consciousness is made up of both of them. There are times in the year that the very time itself is conducive for our godly consciousness. So we're feeling true feelings coming from our godly soul that's gravitating to heaven. At other times, we descend into the lower dimensions of our consciousness. The way I sometimes see it is like an elevator. Sometimes you're in the elevator and you rise up to the 10th floor of your consciousness. And when you're up there, you're seeing things from that higher perspective, and your whole life takes on a higher meaning. At other times, your elevator goes down, and you're operating from the first floor, from the basement. You're operating from the lower, thicker element of your consciousness, which is your animal soul. These are two distinct souls that are living together, and we can live two lives: the life of our godly soul and the life of our animal soul. And that's the struggle in life. Which life are we going to live? The life of our godly, the life of our animal. These are the choices we have to make. So we're going to learn later in Tanya, in the next chapter, he's going to introduce the godly neshama, who it is, what it is, and then we're going to get more into detail into the specifics of these two souls and how they interact with each other.